I'm Alexander Heffner, your host on The Open Mind. I'm really, truly honored to welcome to our podcast today, to our broadcast, Dr. Craig Spencer. He's Director of Global Health and Emergency Medicine at Columbia Med, New York Presbyterian. He teaches public health. Of course, you'll know him as the Ebola survivor who is on the front lines against COVID, who is not only courageous in his service to patients every day, but is courageous in speaking honestly about this crisis and the deficits, both medically and societally in addressing it. Dr. Spencer, thank you for being on.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Dr. Spencer, what's the most important thing you want to communicate to your fellow New Yorkers and your fellow Americans about the current trajectory of COVID?
I think what's really important to know is that we need to elevate and amplify public health messaging right now. We don't have anyone who is daily out there like Dr. Fauci should be, or Robert Redfield in the CDC should be out to let Americans know what is happening, where the trajectory of this outbreak is going, where we're at in terms of cases and treatments. We're not getting that. So I think people are looking to a bunch of other sources, be it social media, be it politicians. And quite frankly, those sources are not always accurate, may not reflect the public health reality. And I think that that's confusing what is going on for a lot of people. I also think it's important that people recognize that, you know, we're not out of this by any means. You know, I hear a lot of people concerned about the possibility of a second wave, but we're still getting over 20,000 new cases every single day, almost 1,000 new deaths every single day. We are cresting on top of this first wave, and we don't have really any indication that it's going down across the country anytime soon.
To the contrary, to the contrary, Dr. Spencer, we're in an environment now where there's been a resurgence in all the states that arbitrarily reopened. And isn't it not a huge struggle as someone on the front lines in a state that took precautions ultimately and has been leveling, if not reducing, the toll to see the lack of a coherent plan? Because as long as air traffic exists in this country, folks are going to come from states that are not taking it seriously to states that are taking it seriously.
Right. Well, I think when a lot of people are reflecting on the response, they're thinking about it both at the larger U.S. level, and then they're thinking about it more locally. In New York City, we had an unbelievable and unprecedented outbreak that resulted in emergency rooms being crazy like mine and many others were, where we had, you know, so many people, an unprecedented number of people dying every day, people that couldn't breathe coming through the door every few minutes, and really overwhelming the system, where at the same time, hospitals and emergency rooms throughout the country experienced none of that, experienced decreased patient volumes or more concern about potentially being exposed to COVID when they didn't have it. And so I think there was and there has been this difference between where hotspots are emerging and the focus that is there, and then this U.S., you know, kind of more domestic response. And I think that there's this conflict between when it's happening in some places and it's really bad and it's not happening in other places and it's not so bad, what type of interventions and what type of responses should we be having both locally but also domestically? And again, I think this is something that needs to be coming from our public health officials. They need to say, not everyone needs to do a complete lockdown like New York City did at the exact same time. We need to think about this not just at a U.S. level and how we respond as a country. We need to think about this at the state level, at the county level, maybe even smaller than that at certain community levels. We need to have people doing that. And quite frankly, we just haven't had that yet. And that's why we're getting this kind of either all or nothing approach. And we continue to see these hotspots in places, first in New York City, then around Chicago and around Detroit, where I'm from, now in places like Arizona, in Florida, in Texas. This virus is going to continue to infect vulnerable individuals. And nearly everyone in this country is still vulnerable, especially older people, people with pre-existing conditions, there are still so many people that are vulnerable to this virus and who will get this in communities all throughout the U.S. unless we have both a domestic as well as a really strong local response.
Right. And of course, as a survivor of Ebola and intimately familiar with that epidemic, which did not reach the pandemic height in the United States, how do you reflect on what you saw in terms of the response in the hospital system and also the contagious factor, you know, the contagiousness of the disease? And you know, with President Obama, there were some initial measures, and, you know, that there was, like with the folks who were relocated from Asia, you know, use of the highest quality medical response, the hospital in Nebraska, right? But at a certain point, was it just so overwhelming in terms of the respiratory transmission of this that it was inevitable that this disease would play out differently than the mitigated Ebola crisis, or was it not inevitable?
That's a great question, because in some sense, they're really similar, and especially the amount of panic and a lot of the preparation that should have come from both of them. But Ebola and COVID are obviously very, very different in terms of their transmissibility, their mortality, a bunch of other things about them. What I will say to that is, you know, the one thing that we learned from Ebola and we should have carried over to COVID is that getting government agencies to all work together, to have streamlined, to coordinate well, was one of the biggest limiting factors we had in 2014 when we tried to step up our Ebola response. That was dramatically altered with the appointment of an Ebola czar, Ron Klein, who has spoken a lot about his experience during COVID and about the lessons that were learned then and how many of them have just been seemingly thrown aside or forgotten. I think the result is that we're seeing a lack of coherent communication between different government agencies now. Sometimes it's HHS, sometimes it's CDC, sometimes it's a different organization who is kind of stepping forward and taking the lead in communicating. And the result is that it seems like no one is necessarily in charge, which then results in a poor response. In terms of the diseases themselves, like really preparing for a pandemic, whether it's going to be something like Ebola or COVID or whatever it's going to be, the next emerging respiratory or viral pathogen, there should be quite similar in many respects. We should have leadership and we should have a kind of a defined hierarchy or chain of command in place beforehand, or at least an understanding of how that's going to work. We need to have supplies. So the strategic national stockpile, which is this, you know, a couple locations, but, you know, full of things like personal protective equipment and ventilators, medications, all those things that we'll need in the event of an outbreak. Well, those things just weren't in place. They weren't prepared. They weren't filled. They weren't ready for this. And the result is that we had this really slow and delayed response in addition to the lack of strong central leadership. And we're still continuing to pay for that delayed response, those lack of supplies, all those other things that really crippled us at the beginning of this outbreak are continuing to cripple us now many months into it.
Well, that's depressing to hear that there was a great opportunity to mobilize medically and to increase the protection of our infrastructure, and that hasn't happened from what you're saying.
Yeah, again, we knew that we would likely face some type of respiratory pathogen like this. There was modeling that was done. There were tabletop exercises that were done within the government, within academic institutions, within the past year to say, hey, we're going to get something like this at some point. These are the things that need to be done. This is the lessons that have been learned from Ebola, from SARS the first time around. How do we make sure that as a country we respond very well so that we don't have this undue and really high caseload and loss of lives?
But Dr. Spencer,
what we're seeing
3 months into this now, 4 months really into the peak, is there more response within hospital systems? Are we more prepared for the continuation of this first wave and, you know, possibly second, third, fourth waves?
Yeah, well, I think it depends, right? Here in New York City, sure, we have this experience. Providers have seen this disease and we know a little bit better how to deal with it. There's some promising data about some potential treatments that lower mortality. Again, there's still a lot more that we need to know, and there's a lot more that we don't know about COVID than we do. But in certain places, we are better prepared because we've gone through this experience. But still, you know, the things that hampered us really early on was a lack of testing, which is still a problem. We're doing less than 500,000, around 475,000 tests per day in the US, which may sound like a lot, and it's definitely a lot compared to where we were a couple months ago, but it's not enough. We need to be doing more testing to know where this disease is spreading, and it's not being done. We still have concerns around personal protective equipment. If you remember from early on, a lot of colleagues throughout New York City were saying they were reusing masks. They didn't have the stuff that they needed to do their job safely. That's still an issue. We still know that personal protective equipment is in a shortage in many places on the front lines today. So yes, in a sense, we have improved in some places, but we're still dealing with the repercussions of not taking early action. And to go back to your earlier question, was this inevitable? No, this was not inevitable. What was inevitable is that eventually we would get some type of respiratory pathogen, some kind of more scary outbreak like this. That was probably inevitable, only a matter of time. What wasn't inevitable was for us to have this really poor, uncoordinated, and really lackluster response. So we're still dealing with those repercussions many months into this.
Yeah, well, you know, let me just say again, thank you for your service and your courage on the front lines. It's more than admirable or laudable. It is really heroic in every sense of the word, Dr. Spencer. What is most frustrating to you about that fact that it is not inevitable, but what we are seeing with the government, it was and is the scientifically illiterate response, and then the complacency, the outrageous and dare I say even slanderous response about panic porn. I mean, you have to follow Dr. Spencer on Twitter because he does some amazing threads on this subject, his treatment of patients and his assessment of the crisis. But I mean, it is what's most frustrating to you still the lack of protective equipment, the scientific illiteracy?
Honestly, yeah, all of those things. But it's honestly the daily gaslighting and really this attempt to turn 100 and now 117,000 deaths, over 2 million cases here in the US, this increasing number of cases, 20,000 cases a day, nearly 1,000 deaths per day, multiple hotspots, to turn this into this idea that this is our new normal and to make us all complacent. And in many places and with many people, it's working. A lot of people are saying, okay, well, this is just the way it is. This is our baseline. You know, we hear recently this administration saying, well, yeah, 20,000 cases a day, that's a lot better than it was 6 weeks ago. Sure, that's true, but it's 20,000 more cases than New Zealand, for example, is having every day. It should be much better. It should be much better, and it's not. And I think people are getting lulled in the sense of complacency and that this is the way that it just has to be. This is not the way that it has to be. If we were more proactive at the beginning, if we are more proactive now, we could decrease the cases. We could have done this much better. Because we didn't do that then and because we're not doing it now, it sets us up for even greater danger in the coming months and in this fall and this winter when we could continue to have a huge number of cases and a huge number of deaths on a daily basis unless we take the important action that's being recommended by public health professionals now. This increasing testing, contact tracing, isolation, bread and butter public health that needs to be done. Otherwise, we are going to stay in this sense of complacency. We're going to have more cases than nearly every other country on the face of the world. And we're going to continue to have an unacceptably high number of deaths, which should not be the case for the wealthiest and, the most expensive healthcare system in the world.
You pointed out on Twitter more deaths than World War I, mm-hmm. more deaths than many crises and periods of combat or war in this country. It is we're living through history that our grandparents have not seen. I mean, you could be 90 some years old and not have encountered something like this. Sure, there was smallpox, there was polio, but not this pervasive. And you point out that if you don't mitigate, and if you do let these states sort of accept X thousand deaths or new cases per day, it's just completely uncontrollable with modern transit. And the fact that not only were folks open from hubs connected to Wuhan and to China, but now you're seeing even, China, which was militant in its attempt to control it, and you can't necessarily trust the numbers, but at least publicly there is awareness now of a new outbreak right in the heart of Beijing. And so, I mean, I do wonder your attitude towards travel, because that was a factor that really wasn't the case in terms of just how rapidly globalized we've become with the original SARS. And I'm sure that that's contributed in some measure to our, to the immediate spikes. But I mean, what is your attitude towards travel within the United States and travel globally? Because that really, the dominoes can just fall with cases as they spike.
Yeah. Right now, if you're, I think this is true, if you're traveling around the U.S., if you're coming from an area of high transmission and you're going to somewhere with lower transmission, I think you need to be very thoughtful. You need to wear a mask. You need to wash your hands. You need to do all the other things and assume that you could be carrying this virus and this disease with you, and this can cause hotspots all throughout the country. You only need, a few people in a certain place to get sick before the spread can go pretty rapidly. I think that we all need to be socially responsible and recognize that as we're traveling around this summer, throughout the state or throughout the country, we are potential vectors of this virus, and we need to act accordingly in ways that prevent the transmission. So limiting our interaction, physical distancing, wearing a mask, washing our hands, all those other things that we know help stop the spread. In terms of international travel, a lot of it depends, right? The United States has a really high caseload relative to almost anywhere else in the world. Many other places are going to require that, arrivals quarantine for 14 days with good reason. And in many other places that just don't have the same healthcare infrastructure, I'm thinking of some developing countries, some places in sub-Saharan Africa or Southeast Asia, we need to be really thoughtful about the fact that bringing in this virus could potentially cause really undue and a painful impact on local healthcare structures and local societies. I'm part of the humanitarian world. I have a lot of friends that work in civil conflict or work in places with weak health systems. What we saw in many of these places that COVID was actually brought in by international staff. And so we all need to be really thoughtful about the potential role we have as vectors of this virus, especially coming from a place, the US, where the number of cases is much higher than it is in a lot of other places in the world.
So, Dr. Spencer, we would all be a lot better off if you were not just in charge of directing global health at New York Presbyterian, but were tapped in a new administration to deal with this crisis federally and offer a public policy prescription that can be sustainable and corrective. So in that constellation of things that need to happen, there was this talk, but not really action when it came to the mobilization through the Defense Act that would allow, mm-hmm. would have allowed deep, deep infrastructure commitments to global health, not just the protective equipment. But what needs to happen at the hospital level where you're treating patients at the Columbia University Medical Center, but also to prepare for an administration that hopefully will take this more seriously. And that means whether it's new hospitals, new PPE, the commitment to therapeutics and vaccinations going forward. I mean, what needs to happen when you have a national government that is more dedicated to solving the problem?
I think that's exactly what we need. The first thing we need right now is we need committed leadership that takes us seriously and that communicates honestly. We need someone coordinating this response who is not the vice president, who, you know, yesterday or just recently was out in public not wearing a mask, you know, not in accordance with any CDC guideline, of course. We need someone who's going to set an example and set honest public health-based policy. That is what happened in Ebola with the appointment of Ron Klain as the Ebola czar, someone to help coordinate and communicate across government agencies. We need that person now, and it could be someone from the CDC. We're missing the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, who should be out there talking to the United States public every single day, leading the global response on this. And they're almost never around. You almost never really hear from the senior leadership. We need one. We need leadership. We need this communication on a nearly daily basis. In addition to that, we need the commitment to building up the infrastructure necessary to not only help us respond to this pandemic, but to continue to respond and be prepared for future ones. That means filling the national stockpile with things that we need, making sure, you know, doing an assessment. Do we have enough ventilators? Do we have enough gloves? Do we have enough masks? Do we have all the things that we're going to need going forward with this and then for a future pandemic? We need to think about how we support states and incentivize them to do the right thing as opposed to doing whatever the administration in charge says they should be doing, whether it's reopening or changing something specific about their economy. Right now, I think that there's a lot of governors who are facing pressure to do certain things because that's the party line as opposed to that's the strong public health principle. And I think lastly, and maybe even the most importantly for our domestic response, is recognizing that this is a global pandemic by definition, and our refusal to really engage globally and think about how we can support organizations like the World Health Organization is going to undermine the global response in the short term, but also going to undermine our preparedness in the long term here in the United States. We are, as you mentioned earlier, we are all globally connected. Anyone can be from anywhere in the world to New York City or anywhere in the US really within a day or two. We know that emerging diseases are going to continue to arise from places all over the world and will continue to threaten the US and other places around the world. The only organizations that are doing this work are organizations like the CDC and the World Health Organization. We need to engage on a global level, support global transnational organizations, because without them, we are going to continue to be vulnerable here in the US and all around the world to emerging threats and other diseases that spring up all the time.
And as a final question, Dr. Spencer, you know, just reflecting again on your experience, the Ebola crisis, you know, in proportion to this for the United States was on a much smaller scale, but deeply personal to you and colleagues who were involved in brave humanitarian work overseas. Have you thought at all about the hysteria of that moment, and what about that moment and that disease perhaps move people in a way that has not surfaced now?
Well, to be quite fair, and to be quite honest, you know, Ebola is definitely a worse disease to have than COVID. The mortality, even with treatments now, even with, you know, vaccines, the mortality is still high. You know, we're seeing new outbreaks. There was a new outbreak announced recently within the past few weeks in DR Congo, which was really just getting over another outbreak that had lasted for the better part of you know, over a year. So Ebola is still super scary. The symptoms you know, maybe have been a bit hyperbolic in the way that they were represented in popular press. For example, not that many people actually have hemorrhage, you know, this bleeding, and it's not, you know, like oozing from your eyes or from other places. But it's scary and it has a high mortality, and I understand why people feared it. They should. We did know that Ebola is never caused a global pandemic. like COVID, just in the way that it's transmitted, it's actually pretty hard to get Ebola. Whereas with COVID, it's absolutely not. It's pretty easy to spread it. We have asymptomatic spreaders, people who are infected and are spreading the disease without symptoms or before they have symptoms. It doesn't kill that many people who get it, which is great. But when it spreads like wildfire, even if it's only 1 or 2% of people who get it that die, that is a massive number when amplified over many, you know, hundreds of millions of people that may potentially get this. Even though they're so different in diseases and it's different in how they, you know, attack the body, I recognize that people have had, you know, fear of both of them. I think the difference, of course, with COVID is that Ebola was not going to cause a huge outbreak here in the U.S. COVID has. Some people have been downplaying it as, you know, quote, just a flu, which it absolutely is not. As anyone that's worked in the emergency department and seen COVID patients recognizes, this is definitely much, much, much worse than any type of flu. It's hard because, you know, we don't really want to overstress how bad this disease is, but we also don't want to undermine just how bad it has been right in our emergency departments.
Of course.
I think that's been a bit difficult in terms of how we message that. Yes, the majority of people who get COVID are going to be completely fine. Many of them may not have any symptoms. A small percentage of them will get really sick. A small percentage of those will get put on a ventilator, and a big percentage of those people will not make it. We all need to make some greater sacrifice for the people in our society, you know, the 1 in 20 people who may get the disease and who may get put on a ventilator and who may die. Because again, the great, great, great majority of people here in the US and around the world haven't seen this virus, are still susceptible. And if it continues to spread unchecked, you know, we'll still have hundreds of thousands and, you know, many more cases in the coming months and the coming years until we have a way to control this.
Well, you make that sacrifice every day, Dr. Spencer, and we as a country and as a fellow New Yorker are so grateful to you. So thank you for joining me and thank you for your wonderful work.
Thank you so much for having me and for really amplifying and giving a voice to, you know, what we're seeing and really our hopes and how we can prepare and prevent this from happening again.
Of course. Thank you, Dr. Spencer.